Etta to DMX, En Vogue to Chick, Malcolm to AOC. Jazz and Justice Radio is doing its part, but we need your voice. WPFW is asking for your opinion as part of its 2024 Community Needs Assessment. More info at WPFWFM.org. It's your opportunity to contribute ideas and speak your piece.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
WPFW in Washington, D.C. at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You have been supporting this Jazz and Justice radio station for over 47 years, not only by your mere presence, but some of you choose to put financial wherewithal behind us, and that's what keeps us strong, your connectivity to us, and I'm grateful. This morning, the language of climate politics, fossil fuel propaganda, and how to fight it. The climate debate is not, in fact, neatly polarized. Partisans on the left and on the right often repeat the same fossil fuel talking points. This repetition produces a centrist consensus upholding the status quo, even as global heating accelerates. What to do about it? Well, focus on language and rhetoric, and here to help us do that is our guest, Genevieve Gunter. She's a former Renaissance scholar trained in rhetoric and cultural politics who turned to climate research and activism after having a child and becoming increasingly alarmed about the world her son could inherit. She is now an expert in climate communication, guided by the conviction that our language for the climate crisis is largely inaccurate and misleading. And she believes that fixing the problem requires us not just to reframe talking points, but to recognize how our speech itself reproduces fossil fuel ideologies. Dr. Gunter is the founding director of End Climate Silence and an affiliate faculty member at the New School, where she sits on the board of the Tishman Environment and Design Center. She advises NGOs, non-governmental organizations, corporations, policymakers on fossil fuel disinformation and climate communication. And she serves as an expert reviewer for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Gunter, good morning, and thank you for being with us.
David, first of all, please call me Genevieve.
Okay.
And thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here in community with you and your listeners after, you know, a really tough week last week. So
yeah,
I'm happy to be here.
Going to get tougher, but we'll get tougher together.
That's right. That's right. You said
yeah.
it.
And so I'll acknowledge that we're in trouble. We are in trouble.
Yes, we are.
But who is this we? It's not entirely universal. We are not us.
That is right. And that is, in fact, how my book starts, right? So what the book does is try to dive into the language that you might hear from politicians on the news, even from scientists, certainly economists, for climate change. And what I'm arguing in the book is that this language right now actually creates this false belief that we can just keep expanding our use of coal, oil, and gas and still deal with climate change anyway. So each chapter of the book focuses on kind of one word that dominates the language of climate politics and altogether creates this narrative that goes something like this. So climate change is real, but to call it dangerous is just, quote, alarmist. It's going to cost too much to decarbonize our economies. And you know what? Being rich is going to save us from climate change. So the real thing we should do is focus on economic growth. There's another word, growth. And, you know, try to solve the climate crisis with innovation and resilience. And anyway, like, America shouldn't do anything because emissions are still rising in India and China. So each chapter of the book takes on one of those words, alarmist cost growth, India and China, innovation and resilience, and tries to sort of show how it's used to create this false belief. And it gives you language that you can use instead. And focus group polling that we did on the book after I turned it into my editor, though. So God help me if this hadn't turned out okay. But the focus group
so it
polling,
works.
It did work, thank God. The focus group polling said that the messages that I outlined for you to take away from the book raise the support for phasing out fossil fuels among concerned and alarmed Democrats and Republicans by up to 10 points. But to go back to the word we, so the preface of the book is about the word we, because actually there is no universal we here. Like, you'll hear people say, we are causing climate change, or we need to reduce our emissions, or we are dependent on fossil fuels. And this is just BS, because there is no universal we. Like, who is this we? Does it include the billions and billions of people, like literally half the human population, that live on less than $7 a day? I do not think so. Does it include like the people who are doing everything they can to try to get fossil fuels out of our systems and resolve the climate crisis? No, it does not. Does it include our children? Of course it doesn't. So what I'm trying to show is that this idea that we are all equally responsible for causing or even solving climate change is wrong. It's like this fiction that gets put up in front of us to hide who's really responsible for the crisis, which is, of course, fossil fuel interests, not just oil and gas companies, but all the corporate interests who support them, and certainly all the political interests who support them, and even, like, to some degree, the media interests that support them.
Oh, gasp.
Oh, my God. Right? Those are the people who are responsible for the crisis. And what we need to do is come up, we in this sense, meaning all of us listening to this radio show who care about our children and the future, everyone who understands like what's at stake, we need to band together to get those people out of power, transform our systems and halt global heating so that, like, the human adventure on this planet, not on Mars, on this planet, can continue.
You're making an oblique allusion. I might as well say that Mr. Musk will be mentioned at some point in this conversation.
Oh, yes.
Who believes in his particular design of potentially colonizing Mars. But can he do it quick enough? I wonder.
Well, I mean, it's a totally, like, I mean, honestly, I think it's a totally racist and genocidal program, because there's no way that you're bringing billions of people to Mars colonizing an uninhabitable planet. So really, he's just talking about doing it for,
a few people. Reenactment of When Worlds Collide for our speculative fiction fans.
I have never read that, so I cannot confirm or deny, but I trust you.
Yeah, if you don't have time to read it, there's a 1950s film version of that story.
Okay.
And it's a noir arc for human beings, so we're not being facetious when we talk about technocratic utopianism being offered up as the problem of our present dilemma.
100%.
So, and I think you're impressing listeners with good hard work demonstrated by your answers. But I want to assure people the joy in the book that is indeed titled The Language of Climate Politics, Fossil Fuel Propaganda and How to Fight It, you're pretty straightforward with this stuff. It's like being at a rally and not just hearing a mere talking point, but really hearing something of substance to have get up and go.
Oh, that means the world to me. Thank you.
You're welcome to it. It's the truth. So regarding doing something about climate change, you clearly state, and I do the partial quote, it's not something we are doing. It's something that we're prevented from doing in this battle.
That's so right.
In this battle part, it's me. Just strategic reiteration for our listeners. 6 key terms, and we'll get into them. This is the one time a glossary works for you folks. It really does. Alarmist, cost, growth, India and China, innovation and resilience. Mm-hmm. So we'll touch upon those points. And in those categories, there's some subheaders or micro points.
Mm-hmm.
The one that really leaped out to me is, well, who do people turn to besides politicians and the media with climate change? Scientists.
Mm-hmm.
But scientists are part of our community. And what they say and do and what they report back to us gets taken in and, I dare say, manipulated. Mm-hmm. The word I'm thinking of is uncertainty.
Yes.
You know, we don't quite know how climate change is happening or how bad it is or the impact. Obviously, I'm puppeting, you know, a dialogue here. And we hear these scientists talk about uncertainty, so they just simply don't know. What's your reply to that?
See, when scientists use the word uncertainty, they're not going to be using it like you and me use it, right? They're not going to be saying, well, I'm uncertain, meaning I'm not really sure yet. I don't have enough info. I haven't come to a conclusion. When scientists sometimes they use the word that way, but usually when scientists use the word uncertainty, what they mean is range of possible outcomes that you can project with confidence. And weirdly, like, uncertainty and confidence are actually synonyms in climate science. You can talk about the uncertainty interval of a model, like everything from the best to the worst case scenario, or you can talk about the confidence interval of the same model. So what fossil fuel interests did initially in the climate fight, starting around, 2009, when they tried to pass the Waxman-Markey bill in Congress, which was a cap and trade bill to try to get emissions down through market forces, what fossil fuel interests did was they basically stole this word uncertainty, or appropriated this word uncertainty, from climate science and started emphasizing in their propaganda that the science was too uncertain or there was some sort of uncertainty in the science, which meant that we didn't really know whether climate change was even real. So why were we trying to pass policies about it? We didn't want to do that until we knew whether it was real or not. And when most people heard this propaganda through the news media, from Republican politicians, in oil and gas advertising, what have you, when they heard this word, they heard it in the way that we know it. They heard, well, maybe scientists don't really know. And then, because that definition of the word was now in the public discourse, every time a scientist would come out and do science communication or write an op-ed or be interviewed and, you know, be scrupulous and accurate in the way that scientists want to be and say, there is an uncertainty in our models, right? Meaning lots of possible things could happen here. That didn't mean they were saying that they didn't know whether climate change was real or not, right? But because the information environment had already been polluted, that's how their language resonated. So they basically got kind of manipulated into confirming or even spreading fossil fuel propaganda without even knowing it. Weirdly, the word uncertainty was the first word I realized worked in this way. And I was like, oh, wow. And then once I saw that dynamic, I saw it everywhere. So that was actually the genesis of this book, to be honest. So yeah, and it's the same with it's the same with the term alarmist, right? So fossil fuel interests will say, oh, people who really worry about the habitability of our planet, the people who worry that we're not going to have enough water or enough food, or, you know, our cities are going to become uninhabitable because they're going to flood all the time or whatever. Oh, they're just alarmists. They're hysterical. They're, you know, women. They're over.
They're untrustworthy.
They're untrustworthy. Yeah. Exactly. So that, you know, we kind of want to believe that in some way, because thinking about this stuff is pretty
scary.
Uncomfortable. Yeah, thank you. It's pretty really scary.
Yeah.
It's not even pretty scary. It's really scary. But the problem is that sometimes scientists themselves, right, seem to also be like opposed to expressing or feeling fear about climate change. I mean, in part because they have been the targets of this alarmist propaganda for decades. So they're trying to look really rational and just only say the things they can 100% stand by.
The ideal of objectivity, no doubt.
Correct. So they want to sort of like embody the ideal of objectivity so much so that their enemies can't call them alarmist, as if they wouldn't call them alarmist anyway. But also, I think some scientists are worried about people starting to feel despair and check out. But what I argue in the book is that the feeling of despair is not really from looking at the science. It's from looking at our politics and feeling like our politics are inadequate to the situation, and trying to downplay people's fears about the science or fears about the planet is not a good way to address that. It just makes people feel all the more gaslit. So, but there again, that's that dynamic where you have our enemies talking in one way, and then the people on our side sort of talking in a way that seems to kind of, I don't know, confirm or normalize.
It's resonating with the framing, exactly, and the terms that they're setting up.
Exactly.
And
so what I say, yeah, is finally that, like, you know, whether we're alarmist, like whether we're alarmed or concerned or whatever it is, like what we need right now is courage. It takes courage to think about climate change and not look away. And that's what we need. We need that courage, but then we need to not worry about the stuff we can't control, not worry about the planet, and turn our attention to essentially the bad people and doing what we can using every political lever and every revolutionary lever we have, I mean, barring violence, to get those people out of power.
Allow me to reintroduce you. You're listening to We the People right here on WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station at 89.3 FM. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But more importantly, I always ask the listener, focus on our guests and the topic. Genevieve Gunter, Dr. Gunter is here. She's the founding director of End Climate Silence. And she's also an expert reviewer for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're talking about her book, The Language of Climate Politics, Fossil Fuel Propaganda and How to Fight It. In the alarmist chapter, you have many, what I call archetypes, typologies, characters. I don't know if I'm going to get them in the right order, but let's see if we can quickly go through them, because we can always extend what to say and what to do in terms of climate change by looking at some of these types of folks. Mm-hmm. One that particularly states out is the lukewarmness or lukewarmism. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what that is? And yeah. Ingrid, go ahead and say who exemplifies this, because some of our listeners are following this issue in commentators.
Okay, so lukewarmers are commentators who very much acknowledge that climate change is real, and sometimes even represent themselves as people who want to fight it or help to resolve it, but who also advocate for expanding fossil fuel use because they say that climate change is not going to be that bad. So we can basically just keep using fossil fuels, let the planet keep heating up, and use wealth and technology to manage the parts that are going to be a little bit challenging, but that's not going to be a problem because essentially with capitalism, human civilization can, as they put it, decouple from the planet on which it lives. So they make this argument basically because they just assume that economic growth is going to continue in the same way, even as the planet heats up, over the niche in which all of human civilization and all of human activity has been created.
Let's unpack that just for a moment, just hopping on that point.
Yeah.
If we assume that economic growth, first of all, we have to assume it's inherently a good thing and brings us benefits.
Right.
Secondly, we have to assume that it continues without any, I'll be kind, significant interruption if climate change continues. What is the basis of that?
There is no basis of it. Yeah. It is literally like a form of religious faith. There is no empirical evidence, either in history, I mean, because what's happening right now is unprecedented, and there's even no evidence in economics. So in the third chapter on the word growth and the idea of economic growth in this discourse, I look at the economic research that supposedly underwrites the belief that economic growth is just going to continue. And people, it hardly exists. There are like less than a dozen studies about this issue. This is not a robust field. And all of the studies do this really sketchy thing. They do two really sketchy things. The first sketchy thing is that they focus on like one element of the climate crisis, say heat. And they try to like look at how changes in temperature or rising temperature affects economic growth or has affected economic growth in the past. And then they try to extrapolate that out into the future. But climate change is not just about heat, right? It's also about extreme weather. It's also about flooding. It's also about hits to agriculture, which although agriculture is a pretty small fraction of GDP, it is the foundation of human systems. It is about human health impacts. It's about, you know, supply chain disruption. It's about all sorts of things, not just sort of heat and economic productivity. So the picture that they're drawing is not going to be a full picture. It's not even arguably going to be an accurate picture, because they're just using one line when you got to actually use like lots of different kinds of crayons. Then the second thing they do.
Or can I break that down though? You really have to consider multiple factors. I mean, you're making that clear.
Yes.
And part of it is you don't have to be partisan to resent something here. What you just described is these proponents don't factor these multiple conditions, constants, but yet they attack people concerned about climate change by saying you're one note to people that, or maybe you have two or three notes at best.
That is such a good point. Exactly. Yeah. Oh my God, exactly. They're basically accusing other people of
the thing they do.
Oh, wow. That is such a good point.
So let me, I feel like I'm succumbing to the grips of time here, but we've talked about the techno-optimists a little bit earlier by using Mr. Musk as an illustration. Is there
at this
anything
point, I would say, I'm sorry, I'm just going to cut you off and say, at this point, Musk is no longer a techno-optimist. He is a lukewarmer.
Ah, okay. Yeah, and we'll certainly talk about some of the current events that are going on that allows you to draw that conclusion then. Maybe, is there anything that we should know about techno-optimism? We talked about this inherent trust of technology, and even some of them are bold enough to say, whatever we come up with replaces nature.
Yes.
Some of them rhetorically say it's part of nature. I'm old enough to remember the industry saying life without chemicals is impossible. You know, on the surface, that's like literally true.
Right.
But what does that mean, folks? You know,
like, exactly. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly the economic theory that justifies all of this, that we can replace so-called nature with technology, and the substitution will be basically one-to-one, and there will be no like unintended consequences. That's exactly right.
And never mind what we substitute for you. So if you're, excuse the expression, folks, some kooky, quote-unquote, don't like to use disparaging terms, nature lover, or you're concerned about just appreciating land, and I think of farmers and people who have a responsibility for the environment, you're just out of luck. We're just sorry, folks.
Yeah, the great economist, Nobel laureate, Robert Solow, who first came up with this theory of economics that, you know, influenced climate economics and all sort of economics in the 20th century and beyond, he's on record as saying, well, you know, if you blow through one species of fish, you could just eat another species of fish, you know, like this whole idea is basically what underlies also Musk's idea that we can just substitute a technologically engineered Mars for Earth, right? It's just the sort of,
because we can count on his thoroughgoing research and work and thinking to take these actions, of course.
Exactly. But techno-optimists are different than lukewarmers. So lukewarmers are people like Ross Douthat at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, and then this so-called environmental group called the Breakthrough Institute in California, who essentially positions themselves as eco-modernist environmentalists, people who think we'll solve this with nuclear and technology, but who also advocate for fossil fuels and who are on record as saying, the climate crisis is just going to be like diabetes. You just have to manage it. Whereas climate scientists say that, no, actually, it's like cancer. You have to catch it early, cure it, or else it's going to spiral out of control.
And also your analogy begs us to go back to the politics of it. If somebody, I'm just going to go there, callously says you just have to manage your diabetes, yet they won't support the healthcare flow to help you survive, they don't have much respect for the person or the idea altogether.
And all of this is profoundly colonialist and racist too, because if you're managing, like we already know that the global South is suffering first and worst from the climate crisis. And it's getting worse every day.
Island nations disappearing from flooding from
extreme weather. So if you're saying that you're going to manage this thing that's already destroying people's lives and killing people in some parts of the planet, that means that you're actually like implicitly admitting, you're low key saying that you don't care about these people's lives. These people's lives don't matter. So there's that political dimension and ethical dimension to it too. So that's lukewarmerism. And then techno-optimism is sort of next to it, but we can talk about that in a minute.
Yes, we'll get to another group called the Doomers, and that ought to wake people up. So listen, folks, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Importantly, Genevieve Gunther is here. We're talking about the language of climate politics right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm in due service to you, and thanks to you supporting Jazz and Justice in our attempts to help build community, build a better world one broadcast at a time. We offer up some public service announcements, usually at the halfway point of our show. Why don't you stick with us? We'll be right back with our conversation after this.
This is Dr. Ryan Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an announcement of a very important event, a national town hall meeting to assess the impact of the 2024 presidential election on the state of Black America and the Pan-African world. Progress or disaster? Thursday, November 14th, 6:30 p.m. sharp at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, 1313 New York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Mark Morial, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Melanie Campbell, Reverend Siobhan Arlene Bradley, Hillary Shelton, Dr. George Frazier, Mel Foote, Maurice Mitchell, and Dr. Melina Abdullah. For further information, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. I join 80-plus programmers in bringing you Jazz and Justice. The public affairs side is my duty, and I thank the people who consider the station, embrace it as a whole, and support it financially. It's very much appreciated. You can do that anytime by using Cash App, $WPFWFM, or if you listen on the internet, as many people do, not only in our 50,000-watt power radius, but across the planet, go to the bright red donate button at WPFWFM.org. You have my thanks in advance. We try to labor and put our shoulders to our task in order to have a better world. We're part of it, you're part of it, and we thank you. Genevieve Gunther, again, thank you for being with us. We've been going through the typologies and extending how language and rhetoric lead to politics, lead to how we live, and I thank you for that. Who are the doomers regarding climate change?
I mean, the doomers are all of us at one day or another.
Even Greta?
If she's felt that, she's never shown it for a day. She is an icon. I mean, we all have to struggle with our feelings. All right, let me not speak for everybody. I have had to struggle with my feelings of despair from time to time, but I keep on keeping on, and I'll talk about how that happens. So there are three kinds of doomers. The first are people who like actively misrepresent the science to themselves or to other people, very often as propaganda to try to get people disengaged from the climate crisis. This is actually a tactic of fossil fuel interests to claim that we still can't halt global heating, or it's too late, or whatever, to try to make people tune out. It's not too late. We can still halt global heating. Every tenth of a degree counts for millions and millions and millions of people. So that's just disinformation and needs to be debunked and ignored. The second kind of doomer is, I don't know, usually like, excuse me, but a white bourgeois man who thinks that being cynical about democracy and collective action is somehow cool or intellectually sophisticated. And they take on a kind of cynicism, a nihilism, really, and a doomerism as their kind of personal brand with respect to the climate crisis, and throw shade on people who are trying to stop it. These people are useless, super annoying, and
they need because to... they won't listen anyhow. There's a hubris. There's an arrogance.
100%. 100%. Because, you know, look, it's easy for you to... Like, I remember Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, some years ago, wrote a really, like, doomery piece for The New Yorker, and then talked about how what he was going to do from then on was garden and make sure he bought all his food from farmers markets. And I just thought to myself, like, he is retreating into his upper middle class white aesthetics that it is afforded to him by his privilege. And that is actually leaving, like, my kid, people who are suffering now, like, everyone who's going to suffer in the future, just sort of, you know, in his dust. And that to me is an unethical and kind of shameful position. So I just have no patience for that stuff whatsoever. Like, if, especially if you have privilege, that's all the more reason to, like, fight for the people who are vulnerable. So those are two different kinds of doomers. And then the third doomer is the kind of doomer that I have to fight against becoming, especially, you know, right now.
Referring to the person, present political developments, obviously.
Correct. That is the person who feels that our current politics, the state of our democracy, is such that world governments are not rising and will not rise to the existential challenge of the climate crisis.
Question, is that a mere acknowledgement that they're the major players, or is that an overestimation to their role?
My sense is that only world governments have the sort of organizational capacity on a global scale and the provisioning power to really solve the climate crisis. We're not going to do it through, like, solar energy just getting cheaper or market forces, or certainly not by recycling or, you know, driving EVs instead of internal combustion engines. Like, this is a political issue because this is something that needs to be done by governments with public works in international coordination, like 100%. There's just no doubt about that. And, you know, I don't know, 40 years of neoliberal politics has essentially unraveled. It's not even that it's unraveled it. It's sort of, I'll just say unraveled, has unraveled people's sense that governments can and should represent them, and that our elected officials are accountable to their voters, even though they absolutely are, and they're terrified of losing vote share, you know. But there's been elite capture of our governments, of our institutions, and part of neoliberal economics has been the, you know, denaturing of our ideas about social movements and how important they are in order to take power away from the oligarchs.
Yeah. And just a reminder to listeners, neoliberal being, let the marketplace take care of it. The market will take care of us. I'm going to do some combinations, being mindful of time. First of all, you know, we started out the conversation talking about a time where communication had a different cadence, less intensity, less immediate impact. People reflected on it. Now we're certainly in a different period where there's a false instantaneous nature to things. With that, it stokes desires and satisfactions that must be immediately fulfilled. And so this is the atmosphere, this is the soup we're in. So acknowledging current political realities, I wanted to say that in your book, you cited that 69% of Americans favor carbon neutrality by 2050. Only a faction favor total phase out of fossil fuels. So it'd be about 31%. And then when you broke it down by party, There's almost a parity, but yet a minority of Democrats, 48%, that support running the economy on 100% climate safe energy. So again, I don't know if there's any particular response I'm trying to elicit from you, but it is a demonstration that language rhetoric followed by action does indeed matter, and it shows up in terms of people's commitments.
Correct.
So a long way to make a bridge, but you talked about this kind of elitism, particularly with a Doomer group, and you talked about how it's racist and colonial. So let's talk about, what about India and China? What about them, folks? They're part of the world community.
So I just, before I move on to India and China, let me just say, though, that I do want to make it clear that I do get up every morning and I do try to do what I can to change those numbers so that a vast majority of Democrats and concerned Republicans and independents will now realize we do need to phase out fossil fuels and will start not only supporting it, but like vociferously fighting for it. And the way that I do that is I do it for myself. I don't worry about the things that I can't control. I don't try to look at my results. I get up, I do it because this is the person that I want to be. And I want my kid, when I'm dead, to remember me as that kind of person. So that's what overcomes my doomism. Also, just like, to hell with those people. They're not going to like kick me out of the fight. So it's some combination of sort of like ethical commitment to being the person I want to be and like spite. So I just wanted to put that out there. India and China. So the crazy thing is that China, who is thought of as this big polluter, is actually like the world's climate leader at this point, and especially after the election of Donald Trump in the United States. They have cornered the market on the manufacture of climate-safe energy materials, transportation, and they are deploying it at just gigantic rates at home.
They have a policy commitment. They actually
that's
have
correct.
A policy. Is it called 1+N or?
That's right. It's a whole policy architecture called the 1+N documents. And the one document is sort of like their overarching plan and goal. And then the N documents are like, you know, documents that iterate how they get there at every single stage, right? And it is literally like a whole of government and whole of society plan that will allow them to peak emissions at 2030 and phase them out by 2060. And I, you know, I've never seen anything like this. Like, they have plans for every sector: energy, industry, transportation, the built environment, agriculture, conservation. They have plans for the education system. They have plans for their state media. They want like to create influencers who are going to model like a climate safe lifestyle. They have like innovation competitions. It's like they've got it all. And they've got a system in place to reward bureaucrats who implement these targets and to punish the ones who don't. It's fully verified. So, you know, on one hand, it scares me because I don't want an authoritarian nation to essentially dominate rulemaking moving forward into the 21st century. But on the other hand, it's like, if my choice is China helping to solve the climate crisis and not solving the climate crisis, you know, I'd rather have a planet on which we can continue to fight for a really just democratic world than no planet.
You know, so. and to come to your defense, as if you need me to do that, climate change and the result of extreme weather knows no geographical, artificial, politically developed boundaries.
Well,
the Pacific Northwest, Canada, India, Pakistan, large swaths of Europe, Spain, Greece, Italy, even France, Canada,
Florida,
and certainly
North Carolina.
Yes. All these places that we're naming have had demonstrable extreme weather conditions that, at least for goodness sake, it makes you wonder what is going on. Let's try to find out what's causing this, you know. So All I can say is that, like we say on the screen, I hear you on this point. Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Genevieve Gunter. Dr. Gunter is the founding director of End Climate Silence. Pardon me, End Climate Silence. Let me enunciate. And she's part of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as an expert reviewer. We're talking about the language of climate politics. Again, being mindful of the time here. I think we've covered most of the six terms. I want to, again, double back and talk about your concerns about when resilience is used. Again, and then we'll proceed to, pardon the expression, wrap things up.
Sure. So resilience is a really interesting term because it's basically used instead of adaptation now. But what I try to say is that it actually misrepresents the climate crisis in two different ways. First, it sort of suggests that climate change is going to be like a series of extreme weather disasters that we can sort of bounce back from, you know, be resilient to. But that's really not the case. It's been the case in the past, but as the planet keeps heating up, disasters are going to happen in quick succession. Right now in the Philippines, there are 4 tropical storms happening at the same time. In Florida, 2 hurricanes came basically back to back. You know, right now in New York City, there's a drought, but there have also been fires. There was a fire in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. There were fires right upstate during the drought, which is a problem for agriculture. So like these things start compounding. So it's not like we can just be resilient and then bounce back and everything will be normal. There is no new normal until we stop using fossil fuels. Whatever that is, that's going to be the new normal. The second way resilience misrepresents the climate crisis is it suggests that what we need to do is shore up the systems we have now. But the systems we have now are actually the systems that are causing the climate crisis. We don't need to shore them up. We need to transform them. And what we need to do is have a kind of anti-resilience, which is Shalonda Baker's term. She is a professor, I think in Indiana or maybe Northeastern, I'm not sure. But she was in President Biden's Department of Energy, and she's come up with this term anti-resilience to talk about the ways we need to create an energy system that doesn't put Black and Brown communities in harm's way. And that centers people first and leaves nobody behind or assumes that nobody is dispensable. And that needs to be our guiding principle, not only because it's the right thing to do, but also because the only way we get out of this is by having a multiracial working class coalition that is allied with so-called elites or suburbans who are concerned about the climate crisis to overthrow fossil fuel authoritarianism. But that has to be grounded in that multiracial working class alliance, because basically, you know, everyone who makes basically the 90% of this planet is going to be much better off after we decarbonize. We're going to spend much less on energy, on electricity, on transportation, and even on healthcare, because
but
millions.
There goes that cost issue.
That's exactly right. So it's the wealthy who's going to have their lifestyles curtailed a little bit, but the rest of us are going to be better off, and working class people are going to be especially better off, because recreating our systems, that's their work. That's the work we're going to do together. So what we need is not to be resilient and shore up the economic inequality and fossil capitalism we have now. We need to transform our systems so that we phase out fossil fuels and ensure a livable future.
All right. And you've got a minute or two to spare. I'm being deliberate here. You've painted a world and a trajectory for us to do things. I imagine some of the listeners want something a little bit more specific, but at least in reference to your book, with the respect you have for the reader, you do say, don't say this, try this, or don't do that, try this. How can people keep up again? They can certainly look up In Climate Silence, but What furthermore do you want to say? You know, one reason you're here on the show, I sense that you operate at a community, that you operate collectively, mm-hmm. that it's not you just trying to be the lone rider into our situations. So what's the word as far as people doing things together?
Well, I mean, what I do work on is how people talk about the climate crisis. And if you're interested in learning more about that, you can read my book. You can subscribe to my newsletter. If you go to endclimatesilence.org and go to newsletter, you will see a button to subscribe. If you go to my website, Genevieve Gunther, G-U-E-N-T-H-E-R, there's a button for my book. There's a button for my newsletter. I would also recommend just talking to your neighbors, your coworkers about the climate crisis.
And even family members. Questions.
Family members, ask questions. And, you know, if people say they're concerned, then you can start using the messages in my book to help them see that what we need to do is phase out fossil fuels. If they're not concerned, if they dismiss it, just plant seeds, you know, connect extreme weather to global heating, talk about how Donald Trump has taken almost $1 billion from the oil and gas industry, and leave it at that. The research shows that Americans way underestimate how concerned other people are about the climate crisis, but actually other people who are concerned and alarmed about it are there, but the only way you're going to find them is to have courage and just bring it up, even if it seems weird or bizarre, because this can also be like something very clear we can organize around under a fascist Trump administration.
Well, thank you, Genevieve Gunther, author of The Language of Climate Politics. Pleasure to have you this morning, and thank you, listeners, for sticking with us with this conversation.
Thanks for having me, David. It was great to talk to you.
All right. Take good care. All the best.
You too.
Listeners, it's my duty to remind you that there's good programming across the day. I'm going to go a little bit deeper into our schedule grid and remind you that there's Kumbit Lakai covering Haitian affairs at 7 p.m. this evening. Before that, at 6, Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and a new colleague, a new hello to Tony Browder, presenting the Browder Files at, I believe that would be 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Sophie's Parlor, the collective of women, longest running collective, bringing music and culture by women but for everyone. Shewanana, Zain El Amin at 2 p.m. covers Middle Eastern affairs, and my good friend and colleague Muiza Mutali and producer James Pope with Africa Now at 1 p.m. Every noontime, we ask you not to forget the blues, the Wednesday editions by Clarence the Blues Man Turner. My thanks to him for bringing us into the lunchtime. My thanks to Mike Nicella, our engineer, and to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, and most importantly, you, the listener, for listening to this station. I thank you for being a part of our conversation, and I hope to meet you again sometime later on the radio. Take good care.
More. cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown. We the people, we the people, all the flame burning bright, ooh, the perilous night.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. President-elect Donald Trump is making a victor's return to the nation's capital today. He'll meet with President Joe Biden at the White House as part of a peaceful transition of power, though Trump did not offer Biden the same courtesy when he lost Biden in 2020. Trump also visited with Republican lawmakers and will be joined by his mega donor and billionaire, Elon Musk, who he's tapped to co-lead a new Department of Government Efficiency with former Republican presidential candidate, biotech billionaire Vivek Ramaswamy. Trump says it will be an outside group that will offer the White House advice on how to drive large-scale structural reform and create an entrepreneurial approach to government. The president-elect says he wants to shock government systems. But he could also be putting the fox in the hen house, as Musk's companies were awarded $3 billion from nearly 100 different federal contracts with 17 agencies last year alone, according to reporting by the New York Times last month. Lisa Gilbert, co-president of the watchdog group Public Citizen, said in a statement, quote, "This is the ultimate corporate corruption. If anyone had any doubts whether the Trump government aims to serve regular people or the billionaires, they should now be resolved," unquote. A report by the group last month found at least three of Musk's businesses are currently under scrutiny for alleged misconduct by at least nine federal agencies. Republican senators will gather behind closed doors today to decide who will replace longtime Senate leader Mitch McConnell and lead their new majority next year. Contenders are South Dakota's John Thune, Texas's John Cornyn, and Florida's Rick Scott. With lawmakers' return to Capitol Hill, government funding is high on the agenda. More from Alex Gonzalez.
Congress is facing a busy lame duck session. Government funding is set to expire next month. Republicans will need to decide whether to compromise with Democrats on longer-term spending or force a short-term extension until Trump takes office. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says another priority is the defense bill.
Every year, the NDAA gives Congress an indispensable opportunity to set national security priorities. This year, it's a chance to show we appreciate the gravity of an especially dangerous moment.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Control over the U.S. House of Representatives still hangs in the balance, with Republicans two seats shy of a majority. They currently hold 216 seats. Democrats have 207. 12 House seats remain undecided. Half of them are in California, and two Republican incumbents in Southern California are in the lead. If they win, they'll cinch GOP control of the House, giving Republicans a trifecta of power next year, controlling the White House, Senate, and House of Representatives. The House Progressive Caucus introduced seven new members Monday in Washington. The Democratic lawmakers, including the first transgender woman, Sarah McBride, say they plan to take on President-elect Trump's legislative agenda. Tuesday was the deadline the Biden administration imposed for Israel to set up aid deliveries to Gaza of at least 350 truckloads a day or risk losing U.S. military aid, a goal Israel has not met. And now the Biden administration appears to be walking back that threat. The State and Defense Departments at press briefings Tuesday acknowledged Israel did not meet the letter's demands, but said humanitarian conditions in Gaza are better as a result of the deadline. But the U.N. disputes that assessment. Its relief agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, said on average 37 trucks are entering Gaza a day for the needs of some 2 million Palestinians. Speaking at a UN Security Council hearing Tuesday, Ryan Paulson, director of the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization Office of Emergencies and Resilience, warned famine is happening in Gaza.
Men, women, boys, and girls are effectively starving as the conflict rages. with humanitarian organizations blocked from delivering assistance to those in need. We can and must save lives. This is a humanitarian imperative, and it is our moral responsibility. People urgently need food, water, medical aid, and other essential humanitarian assistance.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.